Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. At the heart of Rilla Askew's new novel are social and political issues that continue to rend the fabric of America: illegal immigration, conflicting cultures, the abuse of power, and the tension between faith and government. Along with the research she has done to write this investigation of how sweeping agenda-driven legislation affects real individual lives, she has been an everyday eyewitness to the struggle of ordinary people grappling with this reality. The name of the new novel is Kind of Kin. It is published by Echo, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Rilla Askew to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Joe.
You are the author of four novels. You've been nominated for the Penn Faulkner Award. And then comes this novel. What brought you to this particular subject? I was especially interested in a word that was used in one of the reviews that called this book deliberate.
It is deliberate, but I didn't know that I was going to write about this subject. This book came to me because of Oklahoma passing a state immigration law in 2007. That this was the precursor to Arizona's state bill 1070. It was the precursor to Alabama's more recent law. And when I first learned that this law had been passed and first began to see within my own family and acquaintances the effects of it, I knew that I wanted to I knew that someone needed to write about it. I didn't think it was going to be me. I've been traditionally an historical novelist, so the other novels that you mentioned have dealt with from the late 1800s, the 1920s, the 1930s. So I had not anticipated that I would write about this subject, but I was perturbed about the subject. I was disturbed about the law being passed. I felt as if it targeted and possibly scapegoated an entire class of people here in Oklahoma. And so I said, somebody needs to write about this, although I think I was thinking of it in terms of nonfiction. But I woke up one morning in February of 2008 with this little boy's voice talking in my head, quoting his aunt saying, "Your granddaddy's a felon. He's a felon and a Christian. He says he's a felon because he's a Christian." It just went from there.
In looking at the subject, and we'll talk more about the novel specifically, but I found it interesting how we heard so much about Arizona, and yet we didn't hear as much when it came to Oklahoma and what was going on.
I think there are two reasons for that. Oklahoma is sort of an anomaly. It doesn't capture the conscience or the consciousness on a national level very often. So that's part of it. Oklahoma's law did not have a provision like Arizona's did that required local law enforcement to check the immigration status of any individual that they stopped or had suspicion, as that law says, to believe that they may be in the country illegally. So it didn't have so much of a racial profiling element, and I think that's part of what got the attention for Arizona's law. And I think also it wasn't on the national agenda. It was 2007, and Arizona's law was passed in 2010. So I think it was a little premature. There was some national attention. CNN gave it some coverage. There were national articles about it, but it was just a little blip, and then it quickly went away. It didn't go away here in Oklahoma. It did go away in terms of any national attention.
In this novel, we read about Bob Brown. He is a farmer, he is an active church member, and is arrested and jailed for sheltering undocumented migrant workers as a result of this legislation. And his daughter, Sweet, is the central character and ultimately trying to keep her family together in all of this. How rare an instance do you think this is as a result of the law passed?
I don't think it's particularly common in terms of what Bob Brown does. I think that, as far as I know, there is a strong evangelical sanctuary movement. There are churches and pastors who offer sanctuary, but I don't know that there are very many individuals who would take a chance on being convicted of a felony, who would take a chance on harming their own family simply to stand up against a law. So at least let me say I've never heard of this.
So what got you thinking in this direction of what could be?
Oklahoma, and I think many people really across the South who are people of faith, have a strong image of themselves both as being law-abiding and also a sense of themselves as living the Christian walk, let me say, throughout their lives. And so I think that it occurred to me, what if someone took, for instance, Jesus' injunction to welcome the stranger, or some of the verses from the Old Testament that says, you know, when the alien among you shall be, you know, welcomed as your own children because you were strangers in Egypt. I thought, well, what if someone takes that to its furthest logical conclusion about this issue, the way many people did about harboring runaway slaves, for instance, in the North, back during the era of slavery? Well, what would happen? So that's what I wanted to pursue in the novel, but in fact, I didn't think that that's what I would be writing about. I just woke up with that kid's voice in my head saying, this is, people consider themselves a Christian people, and yet they pass laws that don't allow for someone of faith to give sanctuary. It becomes a felony offense. What happens when you carry that to its logical conclusion?
That voice of sweet that you heard in your head, how powerful was it seeing these issues and how they affect the youngest among us?
The voice really began with Sweet's little nephew, Dustin, who's a 10-year-old child, and he is the grandson of Bob Brown, the man who's arrested for harboring illegal aliens in his barn. And Dustin is now essentially orphaned because his grandfather's in jail, and so it's his Aunt Sweet that he's staying with. And initially, I thought that the entire story would be told through Dustin's voice. I thought he would be the innocent who's seeing what people are doing, who's sort of the naive, like Huckleberry Finn. So I thought that he would tell the entire story. But then this aunt that he was quoting in those initial lines, she just sort of came in. She it's a strong voice. It's third person. It's not a first person narration in the novel, but her inner life was very accessible to me. In part, she reminds me of a lot of people I know. She's a lot like some of my cousins and my sisters, and to a degree myself, and many women I know who are trying to hold their families together. They don't have enough money. They have worries with their children, worries with their husband's work, worries with caring for invalid, older, in her case, it's her step-grandfather-in-law that she has to care for. Who suffers from dementia. And so she's got a lot on her plate, as they say, and now her father's in jail, and now she's got to take care of Dustin. And so she just had her own story to tell about all those things. She didn't think that lawmaking had anything to do with her life personally. She didn't even pay attention to politics. She doesn't pay attention to anything except these family concerns and her church and, you know, getting food on the table, until the effects of the law invade her life because of her grandfather, because of her father's stance. And then she has to come to terms with all kinds of ensuing consequences, including the fact that her niece, Dustin's sister, who is married to an illegal immigrant who has just been deported. So there's a direct connection to their family. But that deportation is not what affects her life. It's her father standing against the law that sets in motion the entire plot of the novel, in fact.
There is much consideration of and discussion about guilt in the novel. You write, from Sweet's point of view, she envied Catholics sometimes. She really did. They went to confession, said a few prayers, it was finished. They didn't have to keep lugging their guilt around, carrying it and worrying it, the dadgum gerbil on the wheel. Guilt very much a part of this.
It is a sense of responsibility, almost an excessive sense of guilt, a responsibility for things that are outside your control. At least that's Sweet's point of view. Dustin has his own guilt for his own sins, particularly the sin of lying. That's one that his grandfather's taught him is a bad thing, but he finds himself doing some of that. But for Sweet, she feels an overweening sense of responsibility for everything, for the lives of her family, this nephew, this step-grandfather-in-law, her father's position being in jail, Misty Dawn's, that's her niece's situation, and most of it she's entirely powerless to do anything about, and yet she always feels inadequate. So that's part of it. And, I think that within certain evangelical faith, the notion of sin and redemption is a powerful theme, and right along with sin comes that sense of guilt, responsibility.
And it's all perspective, isn't it, in the sense of if you do something, you are breaking the law, and if you don't do something, you are allowing a fellow human being to be harmed in some way.
Yes, it's a dilemma, isn't it?
Indeed.
It's a dilemma.
And how we put people into that position is an
interesting question. Through laws, yes. I think that's one of the things that I wanted. You know, the book is it's a story. It's a novel. It's about what happens to families. And so though it's about a particular contemporary issue, which we're going to be dealing with and struggling with as a nation for a long time, the issues of immigration, there are so many issues that we deal with where lawmakers pass laws without, actually, I can't speak for lawmakers. I don't know why they do everything that they do, but with real consequences for people's lives. And so I started to say without, you know, regard for the consequences to people's lives, but I'm not sure that they may have absolute regard for it, or they may not. But the fact is, what lawmakers do on a national level and increasingly on a state level and a local level affect our lives. And whether we're engaged with the process or not, our lives can and will be affected.
Although you do address that in the novel, you have the character Monica Morehouse, who is a state representative, a sponsor of the bill, a politically ambitious woman, and a very complex and conflicted character.
Well, that was the intention. She's imagined. She's not really anything like the actual state representative who sponsored the bill, she's not modeled on any particular actual individual. But that's what you're always looking to do as a novelist, is to enter the lives of a character. If they're simply one-dimensional, if they don't have interior conflict, if they don't have reasons, justifiable reasons within their own mind for what they do, it's not a very interesting reading experience for the reader. That's the great power of fiction, that we get to live the lives of others. And I think it helps the reader develop a sense of empathy and a broader sense of what humanity is simply by reading the experiences of characters who go through experiences that we may never actually live in our own lives.
Rilla Askew is the author of the new novel, Kind of Kin. It is published by Echo. When it comes to this issue of immigration, as you say, we will probably be battling this for years. And why do you think it is especially explosive now? And yet is something that we have such trouble grappling with in a meaningful way?
You hear the term so many times that our immigration system is broken. And from the research that I've done and the experience that I have with individuals who are close to me who have tried to deal with the immigration system, I heartily concur. It is broken and has been for probably decades. So it is an element of American law and society that was ignored for a very, very long time, and then suddenly became an issue that states began to deal with. And so certain lawmakers began to try to pass laws, and frequently did pass laws, to deal with the federal elements of immigration that have not been dealt with. Why it's become so important now is that it was neglected and ignored for so long, and we have such huge numbers, millions of undocumented people living in this country, and they are completely integrated American citizens. Their lives are, their homes are, their marriages, their children. And so we ignored it for so long, then tried some people tried to fix it from, you know, by fiat, by decree, by passing laws, but that does not account for how integrated these people are. They are, you know, they are for all intents and purposes Americans, living with Americans, in American society and culture, working jobs, feeding their families, raising their children. And so there are a lot of politics involved, as we know, in the last presidential election. Certainly immigration came to the fore, everyone knows who watched both the primary process, where the Republican candidates moved further and further to the right on that issue, to the DREAM Act that did not pass, to the executive orders to essentially put the DREAM Act back into effect. All of those things have come to the fore because of so many years of neglect, so that nobody was putting particular political attention to it until it became such an enormous circumstance that too much attention has come to it. Well, I don't know if I can't say too much. It's got to be dealt with. We have to wrestle with it. It's human lives that are affected.
I was fascinated by the role that the media plays in this story, especially for Sweet, who must contend with the media and really this berating media. And I'm curious as to your inclusion of that and wanting to discuss it and a concern perhaps that it's the tail wagging the dog.
Well, you know, I'm just an American who watches TV a lot. So you see and listens to the radio a great deal. And I'm on the internet pretty much too, and reads newspapers. And so anything that happens, the media swoops in and pays a great, great deal of attention and tries to illuminate what's happening. They try to distill it, and sometimes they make it actually smaller and less human just by trying to stay in this 24-hour news cycle and find somebody who'll talk to you. So, I've witnessed it. The first time I really saw that kind of attention where the media swooped in was with the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. Mm. I was in Oklahoma at that time, and we were ripped apart, not just here, not just in the state of Oklahoma, but the nation was the worst act of domestic terrorism that had ever happened here. And, you know, not only 168 Americans killed, but also so many little children, little preschool-aged children. And so I saw all of the attention of us trying to deal with, as a nation, with something that was a violent and an entirely national event, and trying to interpret it through how the media told the story to us. And we've done that, you know, too many sad times since, from 9/11 to the horrible massacres that we've seen, the school shootings, and time and time again, we try to wrestle and understand what has happened through the eyes of the media. And sometimes they do a really wonderful job, but eventually, they seem to, in their efforts to make it, accessible to a national audience, and in their efforts to find someone who will talk to them, sometimes what is beyond words, they, in their effort to try to distill it, they make it smaller than it is and less tragic or less human, or in some way, in trying to make it more accessible, they make it less accessible to us.
Picking up on that word human, what do you think communities like the one you write about and communities in general, what they lose in the process of legislation like this and enacting it and in enforcing it?
I think every community has to deal with what happens with state and federal laws that are enacted that cause them, you know, cause individuals to have to make a choice, have to make a decision. Will they abide by the law, or will they abide by their conscience? And in Kind of Kin, the community is a small rural community, very faith-based, in a small town in southeastern Oklahoma, very much like the town where my parents live, and like many small communities, like the small communities and the small towns in upstate New York, where I also spend half my time in Sullivan County, where people know their neighbors. They know and care about their neighbors, and they feel a responsibility for one another. And so when something happens where laws or events that are outside and seem far distant come into their own living rooms and come into their own kitchens and their own churches and their own places of work and worship, they have to make a choice and they have to make a stand, if they will.
When you write a novel like this, and obviously you go around the country and you talk about it, in many times I assume it's specifically about the book, and obviously in this case you'll talk about the book, but you'll also be talking a lot about these issues. And that's okay by you, I assume.
Yeah, I think you have to be ready for that if you're going to write a book that deals so directly with contemporary issues and a hot button issue. I mean, people are passionate on both sides of it, which I understand, and I hope that in the novel, you know, I certainly intended to make sure that I did not write a polemic, and that the novel is about human lives, which is what we're interested in fiction and in storytelling, and yet, I didn't choose to write about it. It sort of chose me to write. You'll hear that from writers from time to time. They'll say, well, you know, our subjects choose us.
Sure.
And so this character who started talking in my head one morning said, it's not going to be somebody else who writes about this. It's going to be you. And so you have to be ready for it. I'm actually very interested in politics. I'm very interested, you know, on a state, local, regional, and national level. I follow it very, very closely. I'm also very interested in issues of faith and how people of faith deal with laws that particularly affect their lives or affect the lives of people that know them. And I'm also very interested in community and the fact of community. You know, I lived in Brooklyn for a long time. That was a strong community in my neighborhood. So even though we think about urban areas not having particular community, but neighborhoods have community, and small towns have community, and medium-sized towns have community. As humans, it's one of our greatest impulses is to be of the tribe. And yet as Americans, our tribe is very culturally mixed. I know so many families where people are intermarried with people from other tribes. We are all one. And when we come up against issues that affect one of us, they affect all of us. And it's in community, and very often in faith-based communities, where it becomes a human question. I am my brother's keeper. Love thy neighbor as thyself. Who is my neighbor? And so those are all questions that are great fodder for fiction. And I think, you know, we've been writing novels about all of those things from the beginning. And it just so happens that this particular one is also tied to the current political situation. But my intention with the novel is to make it endure. It's about family. It's about community. It's about the orphan child. It's about a lot of things. You know, it's about not having enough money. It's about trying to keep your family together. It's about trying to make a stand according to your conscience. And a number of elements that just affect everyday families, probably not just in this country, but all around the world, but certainly in this country.
Rilla Askew's new novel is Kind of Kin. It is published by Echo, and it's such a compelling and beautiful novel. Rilla, I thank you so much for joining us for the program this week.
Thank you for having me, Joe. It's great to talk with you.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.